broadcast live. Studio A, Global Media News. SUNY Old Westbury College Campus in Old Westbury, New York.
It's Global Media News time, live from Studio A. This is Global Media News on OWWR Old Westbury Web Radio. I'm Marissa Evola.
And I'm Miguel Castro. You're listening to Global Media News from the new media newsroom on OWWR Old Westbury Web Radio.
This week in new media news.
Let's start by faking it.
Everybody is talking about fake followers. Do you need to pad your social media metrics? What is the going rate for fake followers on the social media black market right now?
On the fake news beat,
can Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook solve the fake news problem? And if they can solve it, should they? Who should be responsible for stopping this fake news?
From the social media marketing desk,
what is social listening and why should your brand be monitoring their mentions?
From our Twitter reporter,
what's Twitter's latest innovation for social video storytelling? Is Twitter going video first?
From Turkey,
why is the Turkish government jailing Twitter users?
We have a YouTube update.
What was the YouTube apocalypse? Is the apocalypse still a crisis for YouTubers?
Are you starting a career?
Is LinkedIn still the best place to build your career?
What's the latest from Apple?
Will Apple's updated health app make us all happy and healthy, or is it a threat to our policy? Let's get started with a report from Kristen Brave. Kristen has been following all the fuss kicked up by a recent New York Times report that documented just how easy it is to buy thousands of followers on the social media black market with just a click and a credit card. Kristen, can you buy your way to social media celebrity?
So there's a website called Divumi, and it's divumi.com, and it's described as an American media company, and they're responsible for millions of fake followers through Twitter bots, and a Twitter bot is defined as a software program that sends out automated posts on Twitter, so you can buy a number of followers in exchange for the Twitter bots to follow your account. And the New York Times recently investigated Divumi by paying $250 on the website in exchange for 250,000 followers. So when they did this, they noticed that the first 10,000 followers or so appeared to be real and organic people, like with profile pictures and just looked like real Twitter accounts, but the other 240,000 appeared to be bot accounts, and they would have either no pictures, no tweets, or they would just look like not a real person would use them. And then one of the users that they noticed was an account under the username I Want to Be Jess, and it looked almost identical to another user with the same username. They just switched the I and the L in the username, so it looked like it was the exact same account and it had the same picture and the same bio, but the content of each account was different. So on Jess's regular one, she had just normal tweets, pictures, but the other account had like tweets in different languages that Jess didn't speak, and she confirmed that it definitely wasn't her account. A lot of people say that they buy the fake followers because companies and other big organizations won't take you seriously if you don't have a big amount of followers. And Jason Schenker, who's an economist who purchased at least 260,000 followers from Divumi, said that no one will take you seriously if you don't have a noteworthy presence. And a lot of other influencers who've purchased followers are Olympic medalist James Cracknell. And after he bought followers, he disagreed with the practice of it. And he said that it's fraud. People who judge how many likes or how many followers, it's not a healthy thing. And he had bought 50,000 followers from Divumi. The total number of bot accounts on Twitter today varies from source to source. According to a CNBC article, USC conducted a study showing that almost 48 million Twitter accounts are bot accounts. But when Twitter reported on the number of bot accounts, they only found that 8.5% of its accounts are bot accounts, which is 20 million less than USC found. The more followers that a Twitter account has, the easier it is for them to profit off of popularity. That's why politicians, celebrities, social media influencers, they all care a lot about the number of likes, comments, retweets, and they can turn this into money. So that's why these numbers are so important to them. And that's why websites like Divumi exist, to help people build their popularity. So
Gotcha. We would like to ask you a couple of questions.
Yeah, so who are some people that you have found that bought followers?
So someone who was found was Ohio State quarterback Tate Martell, who was a Texas A&M commit, an actor John Leguizamo, and the computer billionaire Michael Dell. And the Times also found that several DJs had bought followers from Divumi, so that's DJ Blau and DJ Snake, but they both said that their management purchased the followers without their permission.
So why do you think so many followers are important to people on Twitter and Instagram and
I think
like
it's important because a lot of people have made it like a career and a job, and companies and sponsorships will want to work with you if it seems like you have a big audience to share stuff on. So you can really become, your credibility really depends on your number of followers, likes, and retweets in today's world. For Global Media News, I'm Kristen Brave. Back to you, Marissa.
Well, thanks, Kristen. Let's jump from fake Twitter followers to the fake news on Twitter. Is everything on the internet fake these days? Fake news seems to be the scapegoat for all our political ills. Can this wave of fake content really disrupt our democracy? Who will ride to save the day? Who should be responsible for eliminating this scourge of fake content? The government? The big platforms like Twitter and Facebook? The news publishers? Who has the solution to this problem? James Ardizzone is here in the studio to talk to us about Twitter and fake news. James,
I chose this topic because it is interesting that people actually make up that these celebrities are dead. Like, why do hackers and random people, like, tweet it? I feel like people, like, see it and they just look all over the internet to see if it's real. Like, they look up tweets, news, and so many more to see if it's actually real. There's also so many celebrities that apparently died, too, like Britney Spears, Justin Bieber, Adam Sandler, and so many more. And all the time, these accusations are, like, always false. And these people who start the rumors that they are dead say they died from, like, car accidents, from drug overdose, or sometimes they just don't even say at all. They just put RIP, like, rest in peace, and that's it, like, and just start a trending topic, and people see it and just go crazy.
Why do you think celebrity death hoax happen?
I think it just happens because they want to have people believe it and go crazy that one of their favorite celebrities die, and that they can start something trending and believable that the audiences and followers will just believe. So,
do you actually really believe in that?
I actually have before. I remember just looking all over the internet to actually see if Britney Spears has actually died. Like, I looked through tweets, and especially because it comes from, like, sometimes an official verified account, which means that it is actually the person or the company or organization, and, like, sometimes it's actually from their social media accounts as well. It's, like, these hackers that are tweeting it. So, but, like, and I also feel a bit shocked inside, like, whether or not if it is true, but, like, I always look for some kind of proof or something, so, like, if it's on, like, an actual news, television, I'll probably believe it, so.
Well, do some celebrities just come out and say and confirm that they're not actually dead?
Actually, they do. Sometimes they do see the tweets or whatever, that they get hacked, or they just see it from a random account, like, just people tweeting them being like, oh my god, like, are you actually dead? But most of the time, they usually do tweet or say something on social media that they are alive. Like, they want to make sure, like, the fans and others, and, like, that they are alive, well, and, like, nothing ever happened, and that it was just all just a lie. So, just to really ramble up everyone, so... For Global Media News, I am James Artisoni, and back to you, Marissa.
Thanks, James. What is social listening, and why are all the big brands doing it? What are they listening for? And from the Twitter desk, what's the latest innovation from Twitter? We will be right back with more media news.
Marketers use social media to communicate and engage with consumers. Should big brand marketers be doing more listening than talking? Monitoring brand mentions on social media? It is always a good idea to listen carefully before you speak, and many digital marketers agree. The key to brand marketing may be social listening. What do marketers mean by social listening or social monitoring? Who are brands listening to, and what are brands listening for?
This topic I found really interesting, social listening. So essentially, tracking like your mentions and notifications, even though that's really key and essential to having a successful, you know, account via social media, digital media, analyzing like trends and conversations through social listening can give you better insight on how to serve your audience better. So basically, the social monitoring would mean something like, okay, replying to comments, or, you know, just being a little bit more engaged with your followers or your audience. Social listening would be more along the lines of seeing the conversation, meaning hashtags. It analyzes all of the data that your audience is talking about, tweeting about, and basically allows you to have a better understanding of your brand and what are they saying, how do they feel about your brand. So when you have a better understanding about how you feel about your brand by listening to what it is that your audience is saying based off of their feedback, it allows you to better serve them and understand what it is that they're saying. And I just find it really interesting because a lot of the times, you know, now more than ever, brands are really becoming involved. And more than anything, I noticed that interaction is just so important. On any social media platform, and brands are actually looking for, you know, the content creators to engage with their audience. It's no longer about just getting a bunch of likes, because before that was mainly it, the numbers, getting the likes. But now it's really about, are you engaging with your audience? Are you responding to them? Are you actually making changes in your approach when you get that feedback? So I think that's really important. And social listening definitely is something that this year, it's going to be very, very, you know, important to apply to your brand, especially brands and curators, so social media content creators. So that's my opinion on it.
Gotcha. What platforms do you think that these consumers are using in order to get in contact with these brands?
I think that there are so many different platforms out there that, you know, offer these services. It really makes it really easy. You know, there are so many different brand social media brands, and brands now also are keeping it within themselves. They're no longer reaching out to these other agencies to monitor their content. They're creating their own sort of social media team within their own brand. So this person is in charge of analyzing, you know, the target audience, what time to upload, when should we upload, when are we getting the most feedback, things of that nature. So the brands are simply using themselves and their own team to engage with their audience and apply social listening and social monitoring.
Gotcha. Have the communications had any, like, any recent communications shown big impact in the brand and marketing? In other words, has there any been any interactions between the audience and the brand lately, and any specific brand specifically that may have just shown that communications is really important?
Yes, and that's such a good question. It's really important that you ask that. So I notice now, before you ever see, like, you know, an Instagram account, and I know now you can shop straight off of Instagram, right? Yeah. So let's say a company is selling apparel, you know, for instance, the company Boohoo. It's a boutique in New York City, and they have an Instagram. And I noticed that before, if you comment, it kind of seemed like brands would ignore you, like, hey, my order didn't ship, and they just will not say anything. But now I look at these big accounts and these brands, and they do respond to people in the comments. I'm so sorry that, you know, your shipment didn't come. We'll have our team contact you. Hey, DM us so that we can get this situated for you. So I do actually see that there is communication between the brands and the audience.
Gotcha. Have you yourself communicated with any of those brands as well?
I have not. I know that from what I've seen, that they do communicate with whomever comments if there's an issue.
I totally agree with that. And I think a lot of people are going through, like you said, DMs and comments and emails rather than phone calls like they used to. And I think it's easier to email someone back and forth and comment on something than nobody's really going to make a phone call about certain things.
That's
anymore.
So true. That's so true. Like, literally, people now, there's so many different ways. I know I wanted to contact Amazon at one time, and literally Amazon would, like, they have like a text thing.
You can literally chat with them
instead of calling
and
them.
And it makes it easier for them to want to respond to you quicker and for you to want to say something to them, because people don't like to talk on the phone anymore.
Exactly. Absolutely. I absolutely agree with that. Reporting from Global Media News, I am Aisha Foster. Back to you, Miguel.
Thanks, Aisha. Greg Mandel is up next with a report on the latest Twitter update. Greg, what is the new feature that Twitter is rolling out? Who is it for? And why do you think we need it? And of course, what's in it for Twitter?
So Twitter here is trying to respond to concerns that a lot of their users have had, that their camera feature is just, frankly, too difficult to get to. And while a couple of button presses doesn't seem that difficult, Snapchat's feature, you just open Snapchat, the camera's right there. Instagram, you open, really only takes like one swipe to get to the camera. So both of those are much easier to use, making Twitter really not like an option that people really go to share videos, although people do, but not as much. So here Twitter's trying to make it so that users come back to the platform to share video.
Gotcha. Have you yourself looked through any videos on Twitter?
Yeah, plenty. And I find that, the other two platforms are much easier to use to upload video.
Now, what do you think inspired Twitter to develop a new camera tool?
Really, just they've had declining users over the last year, or they've been reporting declining, they haven't been gaining users at the same rate.
What do you think they're trying to achieve? Is that what the only thing they're trying to achieve?
Really, they're just trying to compete more. They used to not really have to.
Do you think that's a good idea?
In this day and age, you really have to try to cater to everybody.
Do you think it's going to take over Snapchat?
It really seems like they're trying to kind of edge them out.
I don't think it's going to. I like Snapchat too much.
I don't even
have a Twitter anymore.
That's what I'm saying. It seems like they're just kind of, it's like a dying effort a bit.
Yeah. And I mean, Instagram kind of has the same thing, too. So
yeah.
They're all trying to.
Right.
I mean, Facebook probably has one, too.
Yeah, but you're saying probably because you don't even know.
I don't even know.
This is what Twitter's trying to, combat, but it may be too late.
What do you think could be a good process for Twitter to try to get back into this social media space and try to get back its following?
A lot of what they're doing now and experimenting, or they've really just implemented the 280 character limit as opposed to the 140. They've also allowed you to post full threads instead of having to go one by one by one. So I think a lot of, implementations like this, that's kind of the right route, simplifying the platform generally too. I don't really see how they can really compete with just newer platforms at this point.
What platforms do you see as possibly just having the upper hand in Twitter space at the moment?
Well, really, Instagram and Snapchat are just all over it, frankly. you know, everybody's got a link to their Instagram and Snapchat bios, you know, in their Twitter bio.
At the moment, what do you think Twitter is the best platform for specifically?
Really, I go there for news. Just, you know, breaking news. When I want to find out what, you know, people's real opinions are, I'll go there, you know, before it gets, you know, washed through and put on television.
Sounds good. Do you think that Twitter is a good base for immediate news coverage and news reports?
Yeah, I mean, that's generally all I'm there for, just that and opinions.
Do you yourself have a Twitter account?
Yes.
Do you use it often?
To post, not very, but just to check news, really.
Do you think that there's a couple of things that Twitter can do to have more followers like you to engage in it rather than simply just browse it?
Really realize what it is at this point, that what people are going there for is for information.
Do you think it's going to die out soon, or do you think they'll just keep trying to expand it and make it better?
If they keep trying to compete directly, then probably it'll die out. If they try to, you know, change,
I feel like it already might be dying out a little bit.
Right. So really, my best advice would be to just change what they are altogether.
Yeah, you know? I know. I totally agree with that.
All right. For Global Media News, I'm Greg Mandel. Back to you, Miguel.
Thanks, Greg. Stick with us for a trip to Turkey, where the Erdogan government seems to be jailing activists and journalists for critical tweets. After that, will YouTubers triumph over the adpocalypse? And what exactly is the YouTube adpocalypse anyway?
Welcome back to Global Media News on OWWR, Old Westbury Web Radio. I'm Marissa Evola. Here with me is my co-host, Miguel Castro. Miguel, you have been following a news story from Turkey where the authoritarian government of President Erdogan is still throwing people in jail for criticizing the government. What are they criticizing the government about, and how is the government reacting to negative social media? Is the new media angle to this crackdown on Turkish journalists and activists? Miguel, get us started with a little background. Is there a free media in Turkey right now? What do you think?
Thank you. Currently, there have actually just been two reporters arrested in Turkey due to their tweets. The tweets are very controversial in nature, and the fact that they are protesting and criticizing the fact that the Turkish government is currently bombing and at war with Syria. It's very interesting due to the fact that, unlike here, Turkey has a lot of censorship laws. The majority of the government media is controlled in the sense of television and newspapers are all controlled by the media or media influenced. Due to this, there has also been not only the two arrests, but there are also 150 other activists. Activists, reporters, and journalists that have also been arrested. Not only have they been detained, but they have also been had their home searched for anything rebellious. The terms come along the fact that the government considers criticisms or any other breaches of their own ideals and decisions as potential violent remarks and violent enticing news, which is ironic considering that most of them are asking for peace. It's not new for Turkey to be censorship, considering that they've blocked over 100,000 websites from the internet, as well as the fact that their own president has sued over 2,000 people for criticizing him on social media. The good thing is, though, interestingly enough, that some citizens are starting to get this news due to these social media posts by various reporters and activists, as well as the fact that Turkey has also been the number one user of VPNs, which, for anyone who doesn't know what a VPN is, it's where you can privately search news or anything you'd like on the server without being traced. And it comes along very well for any citizen that wants to know more without being completely censored. It's very interesting, as well as the fact that not only has social media allowed people to get their word out and to become have their voice heard in a very, very limited and very controlled country. But it has also allowed people to go anonymous and get their word out without having to fear being criticized or any potential threats. Interestingly enough, at the moment, all the currently detained personnel are only being held and they're being questioned for anything that might be over the top. But this is still a reporting news, and I will get back to you on anything new that pops up. It's very interesting, though, considering that they're using Twitter and Instagram as such platforms for these changes and for these announcements. It's very groundbreaking to see that even though newspapers and other types of media might not be platforms for them to get their voices out, they are using social media to their advantage, even if it has consequences sometimes as well.
That does sound interesting. Now, which platform have they been protesting on?
Lately, it's been a lot of Twitter, specifically because it has been recently one of the top social media platforms for protests or for movements. You can think about the Me Too movement and how it got its start on Twitter. And just the hashtag on Twitter is very synonymous with protests or any activity, personally.
Do you know exactly what they were saying, or just...
They were saying things along the lines of, we should, like, they're criticizing the moves of sending troops down there, specifically into Armin, I believe, is the name of the city within Syria. And apparently they were criticizing the fact that around 34 civilians were killed during those attacks. And the majority of the comments and posts were all about just backing out of it and criticizing the idea of going in there.
How far does the Turkish government go to censor the citizens?
It's actually, for us, it's pretty insane. The majority of, to get a job in journalism and TV, you have to be registered with the specific governmental party that's conservative over there.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not, you're more likely to not get the job because they want to make sure that the information that is being output or that is being broadcast is strictly their own propaganda. Since then, all of the written work and distributed media is controlled, and specifically newspapers, reports, television, and even with the censorship, the website as well.
Now, do you think that these journalists are actually getting arrested, or they're just getting warnings?
They're currently detained, and I think that the government wants to send a message strictly by having them held at the moment. But the government has had trouble with citizens due to the fact that there's been previous attempts to limit social media outbursts such as this, but it hasn't proven successful because it's really hard.
Are you kind of allowed to do this?
It should be a right, but in Turkey, they try to limit it as much as possible. But seeing as social media platforms are a good way for people to get their voices out, literally from just the pocket, like their own like hands, a phone can become a sword in a sense. I think one of the interesting things as well is the fact that the president himself took it upon himself to sue a multitude of people that were shaming or slandering his name, as they call it. And with that many amount of people, it didn't have enough of a response, considering that there was way more than 2,000 people criticizing him. And I guess it was a good delivery to the Turkish government to show that even though they have physical and attempts to restrict the media and free speech, they can only go so far, especially with branches of social media being as free to the people as they are. For Global Media News, I am Miguel Castro. Back to you, Marissa.
Thanks, Miguel. Let's talk to Joe Fryman about YouTube. There has been a big story for a while now about something that YouTubers are calling adpocalypse. Let's start with that word. How would you explain adpocalypse to someone who is not familiar with that term? Does it have something to do with advertising on YouTube?
Yes, it does. The adpocalypse is just kind of a, I guess, a media term for it, you know, to sensationalize it or whatever. It's more or less describing the fact that based on a lot of, shall we say, unsavory content in the in regards to YouTube's terms and conditions, a lot of advertisers have started pulling out of advertising deals because they didn't like that their ads were playing in front of videos they didn't approve of, be it violent content, be it political extremism, stuff like that. Even just stuff with Let's Plays, video game videos, they didn't like that their content was in front of so-called violent stuff. So they all started abandoning YouTube and not supporting their deals. So a lot of people started losing money because of that. The ads, of course, are part of YouTube's partner program, which is a program that allows content creators to make money off of their videos. It allows people to register for monetization, meaning they'll make money off of how many views and how many shares and whatnot they get on their videos. So because of people like Logan Paul, which is a whole other issue, it made this whole PR nightmare for YouTube, and a lot of people actually started abandoning YouTube because they had no choice. A lot of the smaller YouTubers who were trying to make it in the industry had to either find something else to do or move over to different platforms like Twitch. One of the things that started this all off, there's been a lot of strange, to say the least, videos that have been popping up. A lot of videos targeted towards children that have cartoon characters or children's TV characters in very weird and very sometimes violent or weirdly sexual situations. And all of these videos were made by channels who were taking advantage of the way that YouTube's algorithm works and making money off of it. They weren't, you know, uploading the videos for anything else other than just making money for the most part. There were also a lot of videos of straight up child abuse by people. That was a very big issue for a long time. So because of all of the issues with these videos and YouTube not really being able to figure out how to handle it, a lot of advertisers started pulling out. And unfortunately, YouTube's idea of fixing it was to attack a lot of their creators, and a lot of them were not deserving of it. So a lot of channels that have no bad content on them started getting hit and losing money. There was an article in May of last year, which is when it all pretty much started, by TubeFilter. A lot of the bigger channels like Philip DeFranco, H3 Productions, and PewDiePie were all reporting how much money they were losing over this. Philip DeFranco, in particular, he reported an 80% loss of revenue when this all started. It moved back to, I think, around 30% in a couple months, and he more or less stabilized, and he's also started to move over to other platforms to put his content out. But a lot of the smaller content creators started getting hit by this, and it's started to make YouTube a place where a lot of people don't want to be. Philip DeFranco in particular has been very vocal about this. He's been on YouTube for nearly a decade at this point, and he's a very trusted source for a lot of people. I, in particular, watch his show every night right before the Late Show. It's how I get my news that I wouldn't get otherwise on mainstream media. And he's been very vocal about all of YouTube's solutions. Their newest thing has been a new program so that they could change the eligibility for their YouTube, their Google Partner Program, which means, which basically helps content creators put their content up front for people to see and helps them make money off of it. Their solution was make their guidelines even stricter, and new content creators cannot make their demands. They want, I think, something like 400 hours a month of content, and I think upwards of a couple thousand, 100,000 views per month, which is not something a lot of people can do, especially because with YouTube, you need to, in order for it to count, you need to watch the entire video. You can't skip through it or not finish it. If you don't finish it, it doesn't count towards their count. So it's created a very scary environment for a lot of content creators, and not a lot of people know what to do about it.
Do you think that this whole issue and the various different scandals that have happened recently could give way to possibly other platforms to come into the space that YouTube has dominated for so long?
Yes. Twitter and Facebook are actually looking into rivaling Twitch for some reason. I don't know why Facebook is. They seem to want to set up their own gaming streaming thing. I don't know why they want to. I truly doubt it's going to do anything. But a lot of people are moving over to Twitch because Twitch is a lot safer, frankly. It's a lot... it has its own issues, but it's not... There's no one uploading videos that shouldn't be on there. There's nothing like YouTube on Twitch in terms of losing money. There was a new report by TechCrunch that YouTube just sunk $5 million in an effort to, quote-unquote, foster more positive content. So basically, I think what they're going to do is give more backing and push the videos of people they deem positive or good for their image so that they are at the forefront of YouTube. So they're all on the front page and whatnot. A lot of the videos are geared towards debunking stereotypes and educating people and whatnot. So hopefully it'll start to, you know, make YouTube a better place for people. And hopefully YouTube learns from all of their mistakes in the last few months and stops screwing their content creators over.
Do you think that some of the casualties are the fact that right now current big name names like PewDiePie or Philip DeFranco are suffering, as well as the fact that this might be possibly restricting any potential new media or YouTube celebrities?
Yes, that's the biggest concern, especially from Phil DeFranco, who is very vocal about people starting out a career. YouTube's new guidelines more or less make it almost impossible for anyone to make a new channel, especially if you're doing animation, which is, you know, tough to do as it is. There's not a chance an animator is going to be able to vomit up the amount of content that YouTube expects from them to make them eligible for the monetization. There's no way you can make good content and build a following in that strict guideline. And the other thing is, a lot of people woke up to emails saying that they were dropped from the YouTube program, from the preferred program, meaning they're not going to make money anymore off of anything because they didn't meet the new criteria. They got until February 20th to try to fix it, but once February 20th rolls around, a lot of those people are just going to lose their revenue, and they're going to have to either find something else or find a way to make more content. And it's a scary place right now. And I'm not a YouTuber myself, but I support a lot of different YouTubers in a lot of different fields. It's very scary to watch, especially for people like Rooster Teeth, who I've been following for over a decade. Granted, they're big enough that they're not going to get hit that hard, but it's scary for new people trying to make a living in this thing that they're passionate about fail and realize that they can't do anything about it. I will continue to update the situation as it rolls around. I'm Joe Fryman. This is Global Media News. Back to you, Marissa.
Thanks, Joseph. Stay tuned for a report about using LinkedIn to build that career. And then in Apple News, why is Apple updating its health app?
LinkedIn is the most popular social media platform for business and especially for job search. Marissa Evola is here to remind us how important LinkedIn can be for starting your career. Marissa, do you have a LinkedIn account?
I do have a LinkedIn account, and I actually made it a couple years ago, but I never really looked at it before. I just made it just to make it because I thought it would just help me a little bit, even though I'm not really looking for a job just yet. But recently, now that I'm graduating soon, I signed back on, and it's like something completely different than it used to be. However long, maybe like 5 years ago, I made it. Now I get emails to my phone about who I know that joined. And I put up a profile picture so people can see what I look like, which they say it's good to put up a profile picture on LinkedIn because it makes your profile better. And I just think everybody at this point, like graduating, should have one because everybody uses Facebook and Instagram, but it's not the same. It's not on the same level of social media. Like Facebook and Instagram is more for your own leisure time that you want to be on the internet and stuff, but LinkedIn is more for jobs, and it could even help you get a new job. So there's just a couple things that I was reading on that it will help you with. So one is if you're a business and you're applying to a job, somebody can go on LinkedIn and see what kind of person you are. Obviously, they see your resume, but they could see what you look like. They could see where you went to school, what clubs you were in. You could basically add all that stuff on LinkedIn. So instead of them going on and looking at your Facebook, where there might be a picture of you at the beach on a Sunday, they'll look at your LinkedIn and it'll be a nice professional picture of you. And you kind of sell yourself. So I think that's a good step to getting a job. And you also, it's your own brand and it's your opportunity to promote yourself for what you are and what you know and your knowledge. And LinkedIn provides you with the opportunity to have a showroom for your ability and skills. So say if you have a website or a blog or something like that, or a portfolio of work that you already did, that you could throw that on your LinkedIn site. And it standardizes the information it collects and it makes it easy to compare ability skills of everybody on LinkedIn. And it is kind of like trust and reputation. It's about, they can see what you like to do, what kind of jobs you're looking for, and you can also see what jobs are hiring.
Actually, I have a question. How do you think that this LinkedIn as a social media platform and as potential job giving, what do you think it does to the relationship between a worker or a potential candidate for a job and the business?
Well, you mean like, what does it mean if you get a job off of LinkedIn or something?
Like, if you're on LinkedIn and a business is just looking and sees your profile, do you think it might be easier for them to get in contact, easier to see what they've done?
Well, yeah, because they can reach out to you instead of you applying to their business. So it's kind of like a social media network for applying to a job. Or if you already did apply to a job, they can look you up on LinkedIn and see what kind of person you are and what your skills and abilities are.
Throughout that, do you think that there's any specific... Gotcha. Just give me 1 second.
Okay, yeah. I mean, I just think it's good for everybody to have. For Global Media News, I'm Marissa Evola. Back to you, Miguel.
Thank you. And actually, I wanted to know if I could just ask a couple more questions about that, because it was very interesting.
Sure.
Due to LinkedIn... do you think that, have you or anyone that you know gotten any jobs through that?
I don't know anybody that has gotten a job, but I know people that use it for trying to find people to work for them. And they've gotten people to work for them that way. But I don't know anybody personally that got a job off of that.
Oh, good. Thanks, Marissa. Apple has announced an update and improvement of their health app. Apple Watcher Marcy Mendonca is on the story. Marcy, what can this health app do that's so special according to Apple?
So this update brings together hospitals, clinics, and the existing health app to make it easy for consumers to see their available medical data from multiple providers whenever they choose.
How does it work?
Well, now consumers will have the medical information from various institutions organized into one view covering allergies, conditions, immunizations, lab results, medications, procedures, and vitals, and they'll receive notifications when their data is updated.
What are the benefits?
Well, with this, it's more accessible. Instead of having to go to multiple medical providers, log into multiple websites to obtain your health records, it's right in the palm of your hand, so it's way more accessible and easier for everyone.
With all the delicate documents, you think it's secure?
Well, there's been some debate about that, but they say that the health data on the app is encrypted and it's protected with the user's iPhone password, so it's really up to whoever is using it to be able to decide whether or not they want that and how secure they feel it is.
Now, would you use this?
I'm not sure if I would. I think the accessibility would be very beneficial. I think I'd have to look into it and see weigh the pros and cons.
How do you feel about a platform such as Apple knowing your health information?
Well, at this point, they already have so much information that it's I guess it's just on a user to user basis, depending on how much extra information you think that they should have.
Now, what kind of information do you think people put on here? Do you think they put their actual medical records or just their height, their weight, their, I don't know.
Well, with this heard of it. With this update, it would be the actual medical providers, so the hospitals that would be sending the information straight to the app, so they could access it on there instead of having to go onto a specific hospital or their insurance's website. That way, it's all just in one application instead of having to go to multiple.
Okay, great. Well, thank you. That's very interesting.
For Global Media News, my name is Marcy Mendonca. Back to you, Miguel.
Thank you, Marcy. And thanks to...
Thank you, Marcy. Thank you very much. And thanks to Miguel Castro for hosting with me this week. Many thanks to Ricardo Morales for producing our shows.
Today we heard reports from Kristen Brave, Miguel Castro, Marissa Evola, Asha Foster, Joseph Fryman, James Lardizzoni, Greg Mandel, and Marcy Bendonca.
Global Media News is brought to you by OWWR Old Westbury Web Radio and the Media and Communications Department here at SUNY Old Westbury.
For more media news and resources, check out our latest post on the Catalyst at oldwestbury.org, where you can listen to all of our webcasts and even subscribe to our podcast feed.
Follow us on Twitter at OWWRGMN. Use our Twitter feed to keep up with the latest news for aspiring journalists and media professionals. That's at OWWRGMN. Thank you.